accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. As we continue to engage government executives who are changing the way government does business, we are here on location in New York City. Today, local and state governments are under tremendous pressure to do more with less. Addressing the challenges arising from this new reality presents opportunities to try different approaches, borrow new strategies, forego old ways of doing things, and pave the way for reshaping the business of government. How is New York City government modernizing and consolidating operations for the 21st century? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York. Let's start off by learning more about your role and mission as the city's Deputy Mayor for Operations. What are your official responsibilities, and could you highlight the portfolios of agencies that are under your purview?
Well, the mayor has set up an organization that is designed to bring out the best and most innovative policies of the folks who work for him. So the commissioners are all really strong people in their own right, and creative and good managers. And so I have a couple roles. One is kind of coordinate this portfolio, police and fire and buildings and taxi and limousine and some aspects of environmental, water and waste and the like. And then I touch a little bit up against transportation. So, you know, most of the general operating areas, one that's particularly kind of horizontally important across those agencies, there's two. One is our central administrative structure called DCAS, which is kind of HR and buildings and, you know, maintenance and the like, and civil service and testing and training. And another, which is our Department of Information and Technology, and it's central to many of the reform efforts. So then in addition to that bucket of activities, then what we're trying to do is set up processes to change and reform kind of the structures of government. I mean, the mayor's assignment has been, you know, we have a system that works well, but we have a cost base that's unsupportable. Mm-hmm. Right? So how do we reform? So there's a reform agenda, and then there's an operating agenda, and I look at how the two of those come together.
So what's a day or a week in the life of the Deputy Mayor for Operations of this city?
Well, I have a personality defect which drives me to work all the time, right? So I don't really want to confess my work day, but I work 15, 16, 17 hours a day, and there's generally 15, 30-minute meetings, a handful of crises, a longer meeting, a speech, and the day then tends to get a little less cluttered. Then you clear out the day's emails and go back at it. So really the process is that because these managers, these commissioners are experienced, that the day-to-day operation of New York City government is very professional and very dependable. If there is an issue that cuts across the government agencies where we have to be collaborative, if there's a substantial revenue or fiscal issue, which would now appear to be the case on like almost a minute-by-minute basis, and, you know, how do you maintain services while contracting dollars? I mean, that will raise itself up. If there's a cross-cutting technology, innovation, public-private partnership. Mm-hmm. So basically, the day is a mixture of crises driven often by financial but not exclusively issues, and a mixture of these kind of innovative technology reform agendas that we have, civil service and procurement and technology and digitization and analytics and performance, and those are kind of the larger parts of the reform agenda.
So you've mentioned reform agenda. You've mentioned the operational aspects of your portfolio. Could you give us a sense of the scale of operation? What's the size of the city's budget? What's the status, the state of the budget? And how has the economy impacted your flexibility with regard to the budget?
Well, it's often easier to do creative things when you have a lot of money. Now, when you don't have much money, there's an imperative for change, but it takes some capital investment to produce really transformative change. It doesn't take any capital investment to produce incremental change. You know, how do you turn off the lights in the building? And how do you order and procure better? And how do you copy on two sides of a page? And, you know, how, I mean, there's a lot of that stuff that actually at our scale mounts up to, you know, money. You know, a teacher, you know, the equivalent of a salary of a teacher here or a police officer there. So those issues are out there. But the larger issues are ones that really are based on the fact we've got a $63-65 billion, depending what year you're talking about, dollar budget. So let's call it $65 billion. And that includes education and a fair chunk of health care. But the problem is that that budget doesn't really cover, the revenues don't cover the costs. And the mayor has managed to reduce operating expenses a few times. But the problem is aggravated by, as it is everywhere in the country, but particularly here, these huge overhanging retiree costs, pension and health care. And every year, more and more money goes out of the current operating budget to fill the hole in financing the pensions. And so, you know, when the mayor first started, this number was about $1.2 billion a year. Next year it'll be $8 billion, and then it goes up from there. So just to kind of pause and think about the scale of this, that's $8 billion in police officers and teachers and sanitation workers and social services and the like that we can't not afford, because they have to pay for services that were previously given to the city of New York by its workforce. Right now, you know, there's a lot of argument about reforming the pensions and the like, and we really have to do it. But those are bargains that those employees made, all right? They made a bargain with the, you know, existing administration at the time, and we owe an obligation to pay that bargain. But that doesn't make it affordable, and there's a really serious crunch, and today's budget is out of balance by a couple billion dollars.
So I wanted to actually, I think you've probably alluded to it just now, but what are the top three challenges that you have faced since taking your current position, and how have you sought to ameliorate or address these challenges?
Well, it depends whether one's talking about kind of short-term or long-term. I mean, one really big challenge, I think, is to rework the labor management bargain in New York. And by that I mean, and the mayor had an editorial recently about this, I do not think the problem is the unions, or are the unions, I guess you could say. I think the problem is how the current civil service system developed in 100 years since Tammany Hall intersects with collective bargaining, because the whole apparatus of collective bargaining and civil service in the city and state of New York is really designed to make sure that workers cannot exercise any discretion, right? It manages the workers as if they're a problem, not as if they're an asset. But the whole apparatus, union and management, is designed to make sure nothing ever changes in that formula. So the biggest challenge I think that I have is to try to provide the technology tools and the changes in the relationships that unlock the value of labor. And that means giving labor confidence that those changes are in their best interest. So right now they're suspicious. Mm-hmm. Management's suspicious because it doesn't want to give up. I don't talk about the mayor when I say management, but, you know, middle management is suspicious because it doesn't want to give up its authority either. And then, so we have 200 collective bargaining agreements, and then those sit inside 2,000 civil service titles and competitive exams. And those are then surrounded by a morass of lawsuits and consent orders that no longer make any sense. And so then the challenge is how one gets innovation sanely through that maze.
You've had a very interesting and impressive career. You've been an elected mayor, an academic, a presidential advisor, and a practitioner. Could you tell us a little bit more about your career path and what brought you to your current role?
Well, I've been in public service for 3 decades or so. I grew up in Indianapolis and wanted to go into public service. I'm not sure why, but I did. And I went to law school hoping that I could use my education as a way to get into public service. And then I practiced law with a typical large corporate law firm, which was fine, but wasn't public service. It was service to some members of the public, right? And then I ran in a kind of desperate attempt to break into public service. I ran for district attorney, accidentally won. The other guy should have won, really should have won. And I served there for a while, waiting my turn to run for mayor until the mayor of my own party, who was mayor of Indianapolis, retired. Indianapolis had been fortunate to have a foundation of pretty good mayors, very good mayors, actually. And so then I served 2 terms as mayor, and at the last moment, essentially, I decided I would not run for a 3rd term, and served as advisor to then-Governor Bush in the 2000 campaign, chief domestic policy advisor. And then when he was elected, after the transition was over with, I went up to Harvard to be a professor of government and run the Innovations in American Government program.
With your expansive experience and a very impressive career, in your mind, what are the characteristics of an effective leader?
Well, I've been fortunate to have a lot of opportunities that have been, to me, meaningful and hopefully to others, including not just the things I mentioned, but also I've led the national service movement for Presidents Bush and Obama, Corporation Ask Me Service, Parent of AmeriCorps, and Vista. So I've seen lots of service. So let me answer the question this way. There's a tendency to answer as if you have to be high profile in order to be a leader, right? But, leader is not positional. You don't have to be at the top to lead, and many people at the top don't lead. If you're a leader and you're at the top, you can leverage changes in a greater scale, right? But one can lead inside an agency, inside a nonprofit, and you lead by a vision that is clear about the definition of the value you're trying to produce. Mm-hmm. Right? You're not trying to produce an activity. You're not trying to protect an institution. You are trying to stop child abuse or reduce domestic violence or get people their child support or make their parks better or help them read better or help them graduate from school. Right? So you know the value, right? You know the value. And the value is not an activity. It's not institutional. It's a value. And that's in your mind. And that's what you're passionate about, right? And then you're able to see in a broader way that if you use your passion and your articulation about the mission, that you can cause changes in an existing institution, right? So you can, either by example or by authority, you can move resources in order to drive that result. And so those people are leaders, right? They're leaders by the adopting good policies or leaders by the way they operationalize those policies. Now, I used to teach a couple cases in the Kennedy School, one about the relatively famous Boston Gun Project many years ago. In one of those situations, one of the breakthrough solutions was the probation department and the police department started making midnight calls in the homes of registered probationers, trying to make sure that the young probationers were home, right? That one reform drove down homicide rates in Boston. And it wasn't the idea of the mayor. It wasn't the idea of the police chief. It was the idea of the frontline supervisor in the probation department who's saying, look, the work we're doing is just not accomplishing what we think we want to accomplish, right? So I think the leadership skills can be anywhere. Now, the leaders that you see, whether they're a Mike Bloomberg caliber or otherwise at the high elected official office, I think, and one of the reasons it attracted me to Mike Bloomberg is, look, I'm here to make a change in this. I'm using his words, not mine. I'm here to make a change in the permanent, perhaps, and institutional and structural and the way New York City operates and make the quality of life better. And that's why I'm here. That's the only reason for me to do this is to make New York City a better place, right? So when you have a leader at the top who's elected and willing to utilize political capital in order to accomplish a larger goal, those are the true leaders. And I met 50 to 100 mayors in the last 20 years, either taught them, worked with them, been one, right? And when you meet somebody who says, hey, I've got an approval rating of 75%. You want to say to him, why would you want an approval rating of 75%, right? It means you're not doing your job well enough. Your approval rating should be 55% or 53% or, you know, and you should be using your political capital in order to accomplish big things. It's not like it's a, you know, a bank account that you get to take with you. It turns to zero the day you walk out. So it's people who are willing to make those kind of investments that are so exciting.
How is New York City reforming the way it does business? We will ask Stephen Goldsmith, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What are the seven management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DOD improving its business operations? What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Stephen Goldsmith, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations. I want to move to your role as the city's Deputy Mayor of Operations. And what I'd like to discuss is the strategic vision that frames the city's efforts to modernize and consolidate operations for the 21st century. And you announced it as New York Simplicity. What is the New York City Simplicity Agenda, and what does it hope to accomplish?
Well, the Simplicity Agenda is pretty much what it sounds like. We're trying to change the New York City government in order to make it work better for you. Mm-hmm. In this conversation, you would mean a resident of New York. And it would basically say that we ought to be simple and effective and efficient place for you to do business or get your applications or whatever the case may be. And we have a couple serious obstacles to being simple. One is that we have an organizational structure that says we're set up for our own convenience, not you. So you want to open a restaurant? Mm-hmm. Go to Agency A, then you go to Agency B, then you go to Agency C, and then you go to Agency D, and then if you make it to the end without gasping for air, you get to the last place, right? You know, the example I've often used over the years is this is as if you were going to go to buy your hamburger at McDonald's. You would buy your bun at McDonald's 1 and your hamburger at bun 2 and your French fries at McDonald's store 3 and your ketchup at McDonald's. And if you got to the end, then you could eat, right? And that's how we've set up government. And so that's one aspect. The second aspect is there are lots of rules inside those systems that need to be modernized. They're old and they've accreted over the years. The third is that you cannot run an effective system that's a paper-based system. It has to be a digital system. There's no way with $63 billion, 8.5 million people, that we're going to run a simple system if it's dependent on every one of our employees finding a piece of paper to hand to the next person. You cannot make a system efficient with that many handoffs. And lastly, we need to use analytics, right? So government today often treats every activity as the same, right? So for example, you know, right before we started here, we were talking about a program that the New York Fire Department's doing where they are looking analytically at their buildings. So instead of starting at building 1 and trying to inspect until you get to building 400,000 and never making it, right, you'd say, okay, what makes the most dangerous buildings? What are the risk factors in those buildings? Let's put all the data we have in and let's use the analytics against those buildings and let's now direct our discretion against those buildings, right? So we are now reorienting our services against the problems and making it easier for the people who haven't been historically a problem, as contrasted to tormenting everybody equally, right? So that's how government should work, whether it's a kid who's potentially abused in their family, or whether it's a building could possibly fall down, or maybe it's even a place where a crime will be committed, right? So the deep use of analytics will create a simpler government in the sense that it will make it easier for the people who follow the rules, and it will allow us to concentrate on those who either don't follow rules or who are at risk.
Shared services reforms feature prominently in New York City's Simplicity. How did you identify the 5 key areas for the modernization consolidation, and what were some of the common themes that shaped and informed your approach?
Well, the mayor's had an effort to look at ways to save money that at the same time improve the quality of services. You know, it's easy to save money by doing things worse, right? The goal is to save money and do things better at the same time. And in the city government there, as in all city governments, there are a lot of verticals, a lot of silos, a lot of individual processes that that need to be consolidated. So what we looked at were those areas that were common across larger agencies and where the consolidation could produce efficiencies and better service, right? So accounts receivable were in too many places. And so one group is trying to collect water bills, another group parking tickets, and another group environmental fines, and so how do you bring that together? If we looked at our real estate, not just agency by agency, but across the enterprise, what's that look like? Well, it looks like we got 1 million square feet too much real estate. I mean real estate by occupied or owned by us, the city government, right? And let's start consolidating, changing the office space, open concepts, putting people together, and then get rid of the extra real estate. So that's another shared service initiative. We have, at the time we had, I think, more than 50 data centers. We either need 0 to 2, but we don't need 50. It's either 0, 1, or 2, but it's not 50. So put those things together. We consolidate the licensing and the frameworks and the foundations, and we begin to shed the rest of it, and we save a substantial amount of money. Same is true with respect to enterprise licensing. You know, I think we've reached a really, you know, creative place with some of our software licenses, like our, you know, Microsoft licenses, where we're not just saving money, we're changing the way we buy and changing what the standards are and creating centers of excellence. So whether it's HR or fleet or accounts receivable or real estate or print and copy, we're looking at large areas that touch lots of folks where we can improve the quality of the service.
When I was researching for the interview, I came across one of your articles, I believe, and it was about the post-progressive era. And in that, you had something, I believe, what do you mean when you say fewer rules, more results? And would you elaborate on this vision of the 21st century government you were talking about?
Well, just like in every other area, government today is a victim of its own successes, right? So we're in New York City, so we should pay homage to Tammany Hall, right? You know, corruption and cronyism and kickbacks and hiring your cousins and giving contracts to your friends. So I say, well, you can't do that. That's bad. That's really bad. So let's make it difficult to be bad. So how do you make it difficult to be bad? Well, you set up a rule or two about how you should procure, right? You set up a couple of rules about how you should hire. Then you go, well, that makes sense. So if 2 rules are good, 100 rules are better. Well, 100 rules are good, then 1,000 rules are better, right? And then so 100 years later, literally 100 years later, you're in a forest of rules. And the way you have made government more honest and the way you have stopped the abuse of discretion is by stopping the use of discretion. So if you don't have any discretion to use, you can't often abuse it, but nor can you actually solve a problem. This is what gives credence to red tape, right? You have a problem, I don't care. I have a rule, right? And so I can solve your problem, but that would cause me to violate my rules, right? So the question then becomes, can you change the way we operate to inject more discretion in the system and still hold people accountable? And I think with the analytic tools we've discussed earlier in the interview, you can do that, right? You can look at the outliers. You can look at the way they analyze and make folks analyze and make decisions. You can give supervisors real-time data. And therefore, the post-progressive era will be an era that will be more discretion, more problem-solving, fewer rules, but an accountability system that's driven by analytics and the ability to study the way people make their decisions.
Making it easier for businesses to open and expand is integral for the city's future success. I understand that you've been meeting with the city's small business community to discuss various initiatives around simplifying New York City government and making it more customer-focused. In fact, my brother, a Brooklyn restaurateur, recently participated in one of those meetings and found it very, very helpful. Would you tell us more about how New York City simplicity will advance your vision of an innovative and efficient government for businesses?
Well, there's actually a couple answers to this question. So the one you're referring to is a special team, new business acceleration team, set up to troubleshoot, if you will, for a business that wants to open a restaurant or small business. And it works really well. Great people. They do a terrific job. The limitation of that is that it is an acceleration team that sits on top of a not very well operating system. And I don't mean poorly operating because the people are poorly operating. I just mean because it's just this, there's too many folks with too many different types of authority and too little coordination. So simplicity part one is that a new business acceleration team will be expanded. More people troubleshooting, running, you know, your brother's the client, will solve some of the problems for him. Simplicity two is all digital, fewer rules, fewer licenses, fewer permits, more safety checks, but those are part of a single agency or are behind the front end of a single agency. So you want a restaurant license? We'll give you a restaurant license or certificate to open a restaurant. You don't. We won't give you a grease trap license and a range hood license and electrical license and a plumbing. Now, we'll check to see whether those things are safe, and if they are safe, then you'll get your license. But it shouldn't be this kind of sequential dash to the end or actually a slow walk to the end. So we're going to move from the new business acceleration team to a reengineered process to receive a permit.
How is New York City government leveraging innovation to serve its citizens? We will ask Stephen Goldsmith, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. This is The Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness. Brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level. Our focus today is on CIO leadership with my very special guest, Harvey Capel, Executive Director of the Center for CIO Leadership. Harvey, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's wonderful to be here today.
Harvey, what is the mission of the Center for CIO Leadership, and what are you trying to accomplish?
The center has as its mission to create a global community to advance the CIO profession. And really what we mean by that is to help CIOs to evolve their role, which in many cases is very tactical, very heads down, very operational, largely focused on expense reduction, which is a fine and noble goal, of course. But what we see is a lot of business value, frankly, being left on the table by not being able to leverage IT in more innovative and strategic ways to look at how to use technology to drive top-line revenue, to deliver sustainable business value, to be full peers, business partners, leaders at the enterprise level, driving business well beyond what they most CIOs currently do. So that's really the mission of the Center for CIO Leadership.
So a very timely mission, an important mission. What are the ways you work to achieve that mission? What are some of the things you're doing with the community?
It's a great question. First of all, let me just share with our listeners that the community itself is made up of about 2,700 members. It's a very global community. In fact, the global nature of what we do is a very important aspect. Essentially, we do research, so we're constantly listening to the needs of the CIO community, what their challenges are, what their opportunities may be. We're then helping them to assess where they are in the maturity cycle, if you will, of their own development and their place within the enterprise in order to be able to leverage technology in some of the ways we've talked about. And then, frankly, based on those conversations, based on our understanding of those needs and the gaps, we partner with a series of world-class educators, academic partners, learning partners to deliver education back to the CIOs. I should be clear, education for us is not about necessarily sitting in a classroom. A lot of our education is online. A lot of it is in the form of webinars or online roundtables, as we call them, or in-person salons or conversations just like the one we're having today, where we find that CIOs get an enormous value from simply interacting with their peers and understanding what someone in their shoes has done before them or how someone has solved a certain problem or overcome a certain challenge.
I really want to get a sense from your perspective. Are there opportunities for increased collaboration and partnership between public and private sector CIO and the community at large?
I mean, I think we have seen great success at the Center for CIO Leadership in terms of connecting both public and private sector CIOs in the same. It used to be you would go to an event and it would be for public sector, or you'd go to an event and it would be for private sector. And more we are both seeing, and we are also initiating ourselves, events that commingle both public and private sector. And it is very clear that learnings can be shared. Opportunities can be shared. And frankly, there's a tremendous amount to be learned in both directions. In the case of public to private, some of the social networking, Web 2.0, collaborative innovation kinds of spaces, I think in many cases, the private sector certainly has many advantages around sort of the project management, some of the administrative aspects, the budgeting aspects, the planning aspects, the execution aspects, where, you know, frankly, there are not legal constraints, as we had discussed a little bit earlier, where I think there's a lot of benefit that can be accrued, as well as talent management and sharing as well, by the way. That's one of the other silver linings in the dark cloud of this economic downturn, which has been clearly quite tragic for many people that are unfortunately out of work. But on the other hand, the labor pool that is currently available to both the public sector and the private sector is probably better than it's been in 25 years.
Wonderful. Thanks, Hari.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been The Center This Week. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogren, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DoD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Stephen Goldsmith, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations. A critical part of modernizing city government is saving every penny by reducing unfunded mandates such as pension or health care benefits. The city's cost, I think you alluded to this earlier, in 2001 was $1.5 billion. This year, it's projected, I believe, to be close to $7 billion, and then next year, $8 billion. Would you elaborate on the city's efforts to work with Albany to reform the pension system?
These pensions are not affordable. They're just not affordable. And we have a good workforce, and they deserve a fair break. But if there's not enough money, there's not enough money. And if you work 20 years and you get a pension for, depends on your category, you could get one for 40 years after that. Mm-hmm. So you work 20, you get paid for 60, full health care at 100%, and a pension that's decent. It's not, there's not a tax base to support it. Cities, including New York City, are subject to some rules of elasticity that suggest that you can't raise taxes forever and not evict your tax base from your city. People will take the people who are wealthiest are those that are most mobile and they'll pick up their money and run. So essentially then, if your tax base is at risk and your cost structure is too high, something has to give. And just, I think, just some moderation in the health care and pension benefits going forward would right-size this. And, mm-hmm. and you know, the unions and their leadership care about the city. I never meet with somebody that says, I don't care about the city. They say, look, I have a job to represent my members, you know, and if you have a good idea, then we'll be happy to talk to you about it. So it's not in their interest to see the finances of the city collapse. So now we have to get those interests aligned. And the curiosity in New York City government, as your question indicates, is that pensions are essentially set at the state level and imposed on the city. So we negotiate the pay, they impose the pension, and that doesn't work. Because today, in many of the job classifications in New York City, the fringe benefits, meaning pension and health care, are 100% of the salary. So the salary is only half of the compensation package. So we negotiate half, and the state mandates half, and that just doesn't work.
I was wondering, because you mentioned earlier that the workforce itself is a valuable asset. And what are you doing to reform and improve the city's civil service system?
Yeah, we're in this kind of no-win situation, I think, where both labor and management loses because neither one trusts the other. New York City has a very, very elaborate civil service system, which then is subservient to a state civil service system. So we've got rules upon rules and layers upon layers, and it's just really bad. And so you would want workers to have more discretion. You'd want to have broad banding. You'd want to have performance play a part in promotion, right? Today, I saw this thing from our call center operator. He's really a great guy, and he really cares about performance. And he showed me, you know, the level of satisfaction of workers in one of his shifts that went way down. I said, what did you do wrong? And he said, well, I didn't do anything wrong. We have a new supervisor. I said, well, how did you make such a bad mistake? He said, I didn't make a bad mistake. I knew she was going to be a bad supervisor. I didn't want her to be my supervisor. She was bad before she got promoted. Her colleagues didn't like her, but she scored the top on the test, and I didn't have any choice. Right, so performance has to be a part of promotion, and as does experience. And it's not just who can take the test the best, and the ability to evaluate and terminate based on merit and hire and have broad banding. It's not fair to the 90 whatever percent of workers who work well that the person next to them doesn't work very much. I have another one who came in late 55 times before we were allowed to fire him. 55 times. A call center operator, 55 times. So we have, those are part of our civil service changes.
All right. So you've mentioned performance vis-a-vis employee performance and the importance of that. I want to switch it a little bit and talk about measuring program performance, which is critical for identifying what works and how to best invest limited resources. Would you tell us about the city's very robust approach to managing for performance, and how can the city use analytics to take real-time performance data to the next level?
Well, Mayor Bloomberg has set up a system that measures everything. We have a group that reports to me that is relentless about performance measurement. We have report cards. As you know, we work in a bullpen, and there's a large TV screen, and across it flashes every 30 seconds a different performance metric so that everybody, deputy mayors and the like, see them. There we have widgets and icons on the desktop so they have to see their own agencies, and we have red and green scorecards, and so we got a lot of attention. So then we employ performance monitors in my office, we call scouts, and they drive the streets. They evaluate the cleanliness and the smoothness of the streets, and they report back. So we have report cards. It's not just agency self-reporting. So it has to be the most comprehensive in the country. So it's a great start. The problem is it's not sufficient in and of itself. It's absolutely critical and enormously more than I ever had when I was mayor of Indianapolis. But that data ought to then get pushed into an analytics center from which we can identify the causes of the problems. So, right, so now we're tracking the results and we're tracking the problems. We do have the country's best and biggest 311 call center. We have enormous amounts of data there. We have kind of data from social networking tools. We have information from the scorecards. But to the extent that information comes together and leads us to discoveries about what causes a problem, what causes a type of person to become homeless, what causes a person to fall at a particular place in the street, which causes a kid to get beat up in their home, then those analytics should drive performance like the conversation we had about the fire department, and that's the next stage.
Well, I'd like to talk about innovation, which you alluded to just now, and it's in particular the New York City Big Apps competition as sort of the segue. Would you tell us more about that competition, but more particularly, how is the city taking citizen engagement beyond public dialogues to co-creation?
Well, co-creation and co-production is where we want to go. Your question is really a good one. So New York City, like Washington, D.C., has a Big Apps program. Big Apps program is to say to the world, here's our day to write an app and help us improve the city. And it's a really good program. So we have a Big Apps program. We have a transparency program. We have a 311 program. We have blank programs. But the goal is to bring those together. And so, for example, recently we made available to the public generally and to community boards and neighborhood activists in particular real-time 311 data by the number and types of complaints geocoded. So if this is your retail corner, you can see every complaint we received, whether it's open, whether it's closed, how many there were. And the goal is not just – it's helpful to have that information so that people can hold us accountable. But in the sense of co-production of public services, you would hope that somebody who's deeply knowledgeable about that corner, that neighborhood, more knowledgeable than we are by definition because they live or work there, would say, you guys just need to wake up. That left turn signal is 30 seconds too short, and people are going to keep getting hit there until you change it, right? So I'm hoping to unlock a fair number of solutions by connecting big apps, transparency, open data in a way, and social networking tools in a way that produces discoveries.
So the Web 2.0 has ushered in a new age in which public goods, as you're alluding to, are built privately. What lessons does the web provide government on how to harness the private sector?
Well, I think there's an interesting struggle going on that I don't want to call it old guard and new guard because I'm probably old guard. But and to some extent, we went from no recognition of social networking tools. I'm so old, I was involved in kind of 1.0 where we stood up e-government like in 1990. Indianapolis was one of the first to do it. We didn't do it very well at the time because we were too early. But at any rate. So that was a big deal, and people finally kind of caught on to that, right? I mean, it took actually longer than one would think. Now, 2.0, many in government see it as a communications tool, which it is. But that's really insufficient, right? What you want to think about is that we have developed very professional civil servants. And very professional civil servants tend to think that if they get into a dark room and think really good thoughts, they'll figure out the solution to somebody else's problem. And they do that with the best of intentions and using their professional training. The difficulty, of course, is that people who lead lives often have better insights into what would solve the problem for them than we do about them, or at least that the interchange of that would be good. So I think where we are trying to head now in New York City government, hopefully as a leader, would be to say social networking is a way to crowdsource solutions to problems. And that literally is crowdsourcing, right? We have to be prepared for people to insult us online. And any of us who are involved in kind of the Twitter world, right? Or, you know, we know a fair number of the notes I get are, you know, why don't you quit sort of notes, right? But the number of actually kind of just painfully obnoxious notes is relatively small, and the rest of them are pretty good. So we just have to tell civil servants that there's an attitude, I think, that says if I don't set up a online interactive crowdsourcing tool, if I don't have an online Twitter, if I don't have an active Twitter account, then I can't play host to people insulting me or criticizing me. Mm-hmm. That's as if they're going to not badmouth you if you don't provide the form. So we just need to get over the fact that these forms are going to attract really unkind comments, but they're going to be a minority, and most of the comments are going to be constructive criticisms or constructively compliments, and that we need to engage the public in a realistic way. And that's what we're trying to do now, even with respect to cost-benefit analyses of regulations. I'm going to ask restaurants and businesses, and every time we promulgate a proposed rule, for the city of New York, it ought to be crowdsourced for cost-benefit analysis.
Wonderful idea. And that really does go into my next question about what other ways is the city using or exploring the use of innovative technologies or innovative programs to meet mission, promote transparency and collaboration?
Well, we have a really a vast array of technology initiatives. Some on the social networking side using online innovation tools, blogs and the like to break through the levels of bureaucracy so that, you know, if I can't penetrate physically the lines of communication up and down the hierarchy, I'm going to penetrate it electronically. I'm going to poke holes in the hierarchy with little electronic holes in the hierarchy and ask, you know, I have some visual of folks trapped at the bottom. Maybe there's some version of kind of the Chilean miners kind of hosting their ideas up to the top through these kind of electronic holes through the hierarchy. And we are doing the same, about to launch in early April, a very significant interactive community-based tool to help us with neighborhood-based environmental solutions, which will be exciting. And then New York City has a proprietary private wireless network for employees. And the reason that's important is because it allows us to have sufficient security to do some very interesting things on that system. We've recently stood up electronic water bills. So not only do we get your meter readings through our wireless system, but we now get them, you know, real time all the time. And if you have a leak in your front yard or you have a leaky toilet, we can know it. And you can subscribe to our tool for free and we'll tell you, go check on your house, right? So, but then that will evolve to, you're asking me questions today, obviously to me, not to people listening, from your iPad, right? So we envision a world where every employee will have iPad or whatever the one of the day is, certain categories. And that's not just that you're going to get your information on that. You're going to get your decision support systems on that. It's going to tell you how to operate and where you need to go and you have an electrical issue and you're the electrical inspector, what do you look for next sort of thing. So I think the future is a future of digits, and the digits will unlock enormous amount of value.
You've alluded earlier to the environmental solution around co-creation. And New York City has one of the most comprehensive sustainability plans that they put out in 2007. I had the pleasure of interviewing one of your commissioners, Cass Holloway, and he outlined a little bit of what was going on last year. Would you tell us more about the key initiatives that you're pursuing in this area?
Well, we're in the we have a Plan YC document that is a terrific document, preceded me, plan for sustainability initiatives in almost every area, whether it's water, air, the like. We're now writing a new chapter for that. It'll be out around Earth Day. And then looking more intensively at green infrastructure, permeable surfaces, cleaner water, better energy conservation, cleaner air, and how every aspect of government feeds into various of those initiatives. Its advantages is pervasive and comprehensive.
What does the future hold for the city of New York? We will ask Stephen Goldsmith, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Raphael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye, Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents 7 management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual.
What are wiki technologies? How can government agencies use wikis to more effectively meet mission? And what are some of the key challenges and best practices for the use of wikis in government? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with Professor Enos Mergel, author of the recent IBM Center report, Using Wikis in Government, a Guide for Public Managers, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Stephen Goldsmith, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations. Your career exemplifies a terrific nexus of connecting research to practice, and I truly enjoyed reading your most recent book, The Power of Social Innovation. First, would you describe for us social entrepreneurs and social innovators, and what are the characteristics of a successful social innovator?
My work for 10 years at the Corporation National Community Service, I was the chair of the AmeriCorps Vista Federal, it's called a corporation, it's a quasi-government federal agency, and looked at a lot of really creative, entrepreneurial leaders of nonprofits, you know, the folks who started Teach for America or City Year or Jumpstart and the like, a lot of really great stories. And you tend to, in those conversations, assume that the nonprofit leader is entrepreneurial and the government bureaucrat isn't. That's an unfair generalization. In any moment, any sector could have an entrepreneur and any sector could have a status quo operator. There's plenty of stories about both. So it seemed to me that we shouldn't talk about civic entrepreneurs in the sense that they are only nonprofit, but we ought to think about social entrepreneurs in the sense that you use your position, your leadership, your ideas to drive value. So if you're a public official, you know, in the book that you mentioned, The Power of Social Innovation, we talk about, you know, there's a juvenile court judge at the time in Indianapolis, a guy named Jim Payne, now is head of family services in Indiana, and decided that the nonprofit services to abuse kids were not doing enough good. And he was going to change the contracting standards in order to change the players in that process. So the nonprofits became more entrepreneurial because he changed the rules of engagement. There are plenty of other examples, however, where the nonprofits say, look, what you guys are doing in business isn't working. I have my own model, and my model is going to help kids graduate from high school or college. I mean, you could think in the sense that Jeff Canada forcing folks at Harlem's Children's Zone, bureaucrats and the like, coming around with a new model that apparently works, and other examples as well. So the book is based on the fact that, look, it's not – the issue isn't that we don't know what works for – kids and families in tough communities, it's that we don't know how to take it to scale. We can't take it to scale because in the public social service sector, scale means government, right? You get a venture, even if you got venture capital, you only get it for 3 years, you prove your model. If you want to expand your model, your exit strategy is government. So the question then becomes, how can we provide enough disruptive entrepreneurship to repurpose existing dollars to follow the models that work? So the book is a story of the relationship between government and social sector about innovation and entrepreneurship.
I'd like to segue into the perception in some quarters, and you've alluded to it briefly, that government lags behind the private sector in innovation. First, do you think this is an accurate perception? And secondly, how do you think government could enhance its position and become a leader and driver of innovation?
Well, I think government does lag behind the private sector in innovation because not because of the people, but because the rules of government are hostile to innovation. The rules of government are set up to create predictability and consistency, and that's not necessarily consistent with innovation. And there is very little research and development money. There's very little cross-agency collaboration opportunities, and so no skunk works or whatever. So it's just tough to do it. And it's easier. You know, I was involved with President Obama in the Social Innovation Fund, a small fund that a great idea by President Obama, a social innovation fund designed to say, okay, you had a good idea, here's some money. And I used to joke with the White House that I envisioned going up to Capitol Hill someday after the grants were made and saying, you know, getting interrogated. And so, and them saying, well, what are the results? And I would say, we only had a 50% failure rate. It's terrific. Mm-hmm. Right? And so then you get castigated about a 50% failure rate. But if you don't have a substantial failure rate and on innovation, it's not really truly innovation, right? Because if you're going to have 100% success rate, which means you're not really betting on innovation, because the only way to do that is to bet on the status quo. So the problem with innovating in the government sector is you have to find a way to provide some immunization of the risk takers. Otherwise, it won't work.
Well, how are you leveraging partnerships with private sector organizations or nonprofits to improve mission results and operations?
Well, New York City has just an extraordinary deputy mayor, and Linda Gibbs, who's very creative, done homeless work, done child abuse work, knows the big picture, knows the importance of data, truly remarkable person. And so she's using analytics and performance contracting to kind of change the way we produce services in a very tough and declining market. I'm trying to play a part in that across government by analytics and better use of information.
Crystal ball time, if you will, prognostication. What are some of the major opportunities and challenges your organization, your role will encounter in the future? And how do you envision the office or the group that you lead evolving to meet those challenges and seize opportunities?
Well, I have a small band of warriors who work with me, and they work on projects across the agencies. The challenge really is that it's very difficult if you've been in government a long time or anywhere and you're highly professional and you're in a routine to understand that that routine may no longer be working. You tend to think if it's not working, that means you need to do more of it, not different stuff. And the challenge will be to, if we can, get people to see that new tools, new approaches are necessary and want to do them, as contrasted to say, no, that's too threatening. I have to kind of hold on to the way we do things today. That will be the ultimate challenge, and that will be affected by whether citizens demand better services and support the governmental entrepreneurs. And anytime you make a change, the people who are against the change know who they are. They're very involved, and they're very antagonistic. And the people who benefit from the change are inchoate, they're diffused, they're not involved yet, right? And so we have to motivate the general public to overcome the obstacles of the special interests.
What advice would you give to someone who's considering a career in public service?
This is a great career. One should engage in it, and you don't have to engage in it for a lifetime. To some extent, if you want to, fine. But some of the best and the brightest and the folks who make the biggest difference, just, you know, like any other young adult in today's world, they don't want to have one employer for life. Mm-hmm. And the government systems assume that that's how you're going to operate. So I was talking to somebody yesterday, and she said, how do I decide? What do I do? So, you know, basically you find a really good person who wants to change the world and attach yourself to them, and that should be your public service, and then you could magnify his or her role.
Well, Steve, I want to thank you for your time today, but more importantly, I'd like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country and to the city of New York.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure and honor to serve.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
What are wiki technologies? How can government agencies use wikis to more effectively meet mission? And what are some of the key challenges and best practices for the use of wikis in government? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with Professor Enos Mergel, author of the recent IBM Center report, Using Wikis in Government, a Guide for Public Managers, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Top story, should the U.S. get rid of its debt ceiling? CNN's Allison Kosick reports that might prevent